Hello, everyone. Hi, I am Roslyn, your wellness and health life coach here at Alchemic Aura. My company is a holistic company that addresses all things for the mind, body, and spirit. And our goal is to elevate your alchemic vibration in order to manifest wellness and wholeness in your whole body. And that comes with a little help from nature. My name again is Roslyn Collins. Can everyone hear me? Okay. I'm a certified health and wellness life coach, personal fitness trainer. I'm also a practitioner of reflexology, aromatherapy, emotional trauma release therapy, raindrop therapy, cosmology, cosmogony, herbal and homeopathic remedies. I'm basically a lifelong student of ancient alternative therapies. And right now I'm studying Reiki and chakra healing. I'm one half of Fit to Heal. The other half is the Fit Goddess. And we're here to promote fitness in the mind, the body, and the spirit. And that fitness also translates to fiscal fitness, which is money. So for the benefit of tonight's show, I'm going to let you know that I am a commissioned notary signing agent because economics touches all of our lives. And so as we conclude the month of April, Stress Awareness Month, we are still addressing the stresses that come with money mindset, the money mindset, overstanding financial intelligence, and how to remove the traumas and the incorrect belief systems that are tied to how we manage it or mismanage it, depending on how you do that thing. I'm so happy to have Brother Minister Zumi back with us tonight. You absolutely floored me last week with your wisdom and insight on the show. We also have some other phenomenal guests tonight, and we can't wait to share with you. So if the goddess is ready, let's talk about how to take the stress off the money.
Ooh, that's right. All right. So, Mama, first, let's start. We can't see you. We hear your voice. It's lovely, but we can't see your phenomenal face. Would you? There we go. Oh, much better.
Hang on a second. How's that?
Perfect. All right, so like you said, let's take the stress off of money. Brother Zumbi, in your book, what are the first details that you could share with us that talks about taking the stress off of money, making it easier for all of us?
When I first put the book together, and I'm particularly talking, I wrote it with the African world community in mind. Everything had to begin with a philosophy. Okay. There are a lot of books out there that deal with money. They deal with the how-to and everything. But there's very few, if any, that come from an African-centered perspective. Okay. And I think if we begin to view the science of what I call the science of beef, beef being business, economics, entrepreneurship, and finance through an African-centered lens, then I think we will have taken a huge step towards eradicating the traumas that we've suffered in some cases. I would dare say multi-generational traumas. When it comes to money, economics, business, et cetera. So I started with creating a philosophy first, because once you create the philosophy, now you can begin to instill the tools. Because if I give you a tools without a philosophy, you can begin to do things with your resources that are not in your best interest. So everything begins with a philosophy, or what I would like to call a Black economic liberation theology.
Liberation. So describe what that means to you, because a lot of people, I think, misuse the word liberation. Now, I'm not saying you specifically, but I don't think a lot of people know what true liberation stands for.
Okay. When I decided to call it a Black economic liberation theology, a lot of times liberation, meaning liberating from something and being liberated to do something. Okay. So liberation from, obviously, poverty, poverty consciousness, scarcity, scarcity consciousness. Okay. Liberated to do certain things. So liberation isn't, it's not an end game in and of itself. It's a starting point. Okay. So like some of the things we'll probably talk about tonight, having the economic liberation to begin creating multi-generational wealth for your immediate and extended family, having the economic resources to practice what I call cultural tithing, where you give to a race first or an African-centered organization that looks out for the well-being of the African world community. Okay, so it's a twofold thing. You're being liberated from something and then liberated to do something that is in the highest and greatest good of the African world community.
Now, see, I love that you said liberated from something and to do something. So with the Fit Goddess Tribe, we always say we think and then we say and then we do. It sounds like your theology, your philosophy is a lot in that same kind of old African proverb, you know, do as I do, not do as I say.
Yeah, our Moorish family would say, show us your demonstration.
That's right.
Okay. And I think when it comes to the area of economics, we really have to be not only about the conversation, but the demonstration. You know, Dr. Chike Okuwa, he always teaches that demonstration beats conversation every time.
Ooh. Now, I run into this problem because I'm kind of like the bridge between the youth and the elders, right? I'm right in that sweet spot where I'm still a baby, but not really. Mm. And with a lot of the elders, they do a lot of talking. And I don't know, you know, I understand that they're in a mindset. They've been through way more traumas and at a different, you know, propensity than myself. But how do we help push them and guide them to go from that mindset? Because, like I said, we always talk about reading your book, but if you don't have the mental capacity, the self-belief, the self-worth, the understanding, you won't, I don't believe, take your book and actually do anything with it other than read it.
I think it comes down to how strong is your why. Ooh. Okay. Most books out there give you a how-to, but how many books or how many systems that have been developed give you a strong enough why? Hmm. Why is it that you want this economic liberation? What is your driving force? You know, I think in the last show, I talked about having a clearly defined mission, vision, and purpose. Okay. And when we start with the vision, who do you aspire to be in your financial life? Huh. Okay. In your mission is, what do you intend to achieve and accomplish? And then for purpose, what is your driving force? What makes you do the things that you do with the financial resources that you receive? So it's about having a clearly defined MVP or mission, vision, and purpose, and having a strong enough why to, because here's what I tell people, your why has to be greater than money. Because when you hit that wall or when you go through that adversity, if money is your primary motivator, you won't make it.
True indeed.
Yeah,
okay. Absolutely. Because it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Ooh, it's chess, not checkers.
Okay.
So all right, Brother Zuby, let me see your credit score. But seriously, it's a real hot topic. You know, in finances, there's so much, even in business, that our demographic is still trying to learn and grasp. Mm-hmm. How powerful, what's the credit score? How do you break it down in your book? What should we know about it?
I don't know if I really get into the credit score that much, because I think there are other entities that, you know, deal with it maybe better than I could. But the thing you have to understand about a credit score, basically, it only means how much debt can you handle? Okay. Now, I'll give you an example. Me being in upstate New York, I'm in Albany. So every year I'll take a trip to the Harlem Book Fair. There was one year I went to the Harlem Book Fair where there was a gentleman, I think it was a CPA or something, and we were talking about financial literacy. One of the things he said about debt really stuck with me. He says, going into debt is like going into war. And the reason he put it that way is because what gets people in trouble when you start accumulating debt is that you don't have an exit strategy for how to get out of it before you get into it. Hmm. Okay. Yeah. And the main reason why you use debt, and this is what separates the rich from the poor and the middle class. Okay. Rich people use debt for one reason and one reason only: to make more money. They use debt to accumulate assets. Whereas if you see what the poor and the middle class do with debt, I mean, think about it. When was the last time you ever heard rich people about having a car note or mortgage or financing something that depreciates in value over time? Okay. So there's a science, like you were saying earlier, there's a science that we're still learning about the science of money, the science of economics. How do we use these tools to our advantage? So I don't want to say we're playing catch up per se, but it's like, it's an ongoing, never ending learning process on this science we call economics.
So then how do we catch up?
Here's what I tell people: don't play a catch up game. Okay. Because when you start trying to play a catch up game, it's like you're making someone outside of you the standard. Okay. So
our standard is ourself, right?
Right. We should be our own standard. Okay. But everybody with that talks logic, about
it. What about self-hate? And I don't mean to cut you off, but this is going to be very deep for me. A lot of us don't think highly enough about ourselves for that standard of finances to be high. Like you said, the scarcity mindset or the poverty mindset, it's ingrained. So how do we elevate the thinking of self to elevate to that financial standard?
I'll tell you how I do it. Like everybody talks about, oh, we got to close the wealth gap. You know, where basically subconsciously you are still making white people the standard. But if you look at the condition that white people have put this planet in economically, why would you want to be equal to that? Think about it. Why would you want to be equal to a people who have economically wrecked this planet? So for me, that's where I start in terms of, okay, who, you know, like Ice Cube said in Who's the Mac, who are they to be equal to? So for African people, and like you said, it really goes back to beginning of changing thought, changing language, changing behavior. And it's almost a simultaneous thing that we have to do. It's almost like you have to be diametrically opposed to what is the so-called norm. In other words, they said, if you want to, if you don't want to dig a deeper hole, stop digging. Okay.
All right. So I got a little something to share to help the viewers out with elevating that kind of mindset. Like I said, most of us don't know a lot of our history. So I just wanted to share this. This Mansa Musa, he's the king of Mali, an ancient empire in West Africa. So we know what empires are. We know that it's bigger than just a country or a continent. It's ruling massive amounts of individuals and people. And then for a period of time, right, as we see here from 1312 CE to 1337. But this is my favorite part, right? Mali, right, in West Africa, was one of the richest kingdoms. And then Mansa Musa was one of the richest individuals. So just to bring it all together, right, bring it all to head, I think the idea of us elevating, it's like Afrofuturism. We're going back to ourselves, where we were kings and queens and gods and goddesses. Now, Mama, you're a little quiet over there.
I'm just listening because you're hitting so many points. I can't hardly keep up with you guys. I'm telling you, I tell you this, you know, my children, especially my oldest daughter, I didn't understand money until I was an adult. You know, I just learned that you're not supposed to use your own money. You're supposed to use your own money, but you don't create debt to do it. That all of the tools that we've been taught to use have been misused. Life insurance is not for death, it's for life, it's for living. And that mindset, the belief system of the capitalist society that we are living in, kind of tricked us up and told us, you know, you use this money to pay for you when you die. And don't worry about living, just plan for death. Ooh. And as a child, I remember, I know a whole lot of other people in my age bracket remembers the insurance man coming to collect payment and the mother telling the kids to hide and be quiet, because she didn't want to answer the door to pay her insurance premium.
Oh, the tax man.
No, the insurance man.
Ooh.
I remember it. Just like when the Jehovah's Witness people came, you know, running you high. And I thought it was so weird until I understood it, you know, as an adult. And I'm telling you, this is just a couple of years ago. I'm learning that the way that we've been taught how to use money, lines of credit, you know, all of the things that keep others in a position where they are not in poverty and living scarcity, we were taught you make the money, you spend the money. You go back, you make some more money, you spend the money. You don't plan for the future, you just keep chasing that and you keep digging and you keep digging deeper and deeper into debt. And this, the sad part about it is that the language, as you mentioned, Brother Minister, is the part that's so obvious that it's killing us. What does the word mortgage mean? It means death grip.
Yeah.
You put it right there in our faces, as plain as day. You're going to die owing money because we don't know how to use real estate. We don't know how to use insurance. We don't know how to use the lines of credit. We don't know how to use the tools properly. So I'm listening and waiting. Yeah. I'm going to be quiet now because I know you're going to hit me. Get me.
Well,
get me
there's right. Okay. And there's another thing. The elder was talking about history. Okay. Our ancestor, Ida B. Wells Barnett, did a study. She was a journalist. She basically had her own newsletter, and she did a study that probably plays into the epigenetics of why we are the way we are collectively when it comes to economics. She said that of all the people that were lynched, African people who were lynched, over 80% of them were business owners and entrepreneurs. Now, just let that sink in for a minute. Okay. If the bulk of the people who were lynched at the time that Ida B. Wells did this study were business owners and entrepreneurs, what type of impact would that have, not only short term, but long term?
Not to mention happened in Oklahoma in 1921.
Okay. Now, what I would label the situation in Tulsa, I would call that a form of domestic economic terrorism.
That's what it is, yeah.
Okay. Domestic economic terrorism. And the one thing that I think we don't get when you study economics is when you build something, there must be a self-defense mechanism in place to protect it. Okay. So what good is it for you to build an economic empire if you're not going to build a defense mechanism to protect the interests?
Right.
Okay. This is the thing that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was talking about in Message to the Black Man, where he said that there were three sciences that a people had to master in order to have any sense or any form of civilization. The first being what I call the science of beef, business, economics, entrepreneurship, and finance. The second science being the science of diplomacy, negotiation, and warfare. Okay. And then the third is the science of mate selection and genetic engineering. Now, I'll also throw in two more sciences, the science of education, and then the last science, which really affects the previous four, is the science of culture. Now, all of those sciences affect our economics, because think about it. You need diplomacy, negotiation, and warfare to make sure that you are protecting your economic interests. Okay. You need to understand the science of genetic engineering and mate selection, because as we talk about marriage and we talk about the accumulation of resources, are we using corporations and trusts to make sure that we protect our resources and can bequeath them to future generations?
Right.
When we talk about the science of education, okay, are we getting information that is relevant to our condition as a people? Okay. And then finally, culture. Are we studying economics through an African-centered lens? Okay. So all of those sciences actually are working together synergistically, if that makes any sense.
So break it down in terms of Afrocentric, because a lot of people don't understand vision. A lot of people lack regular sight. So to see something from a different vantage point, you would have to understand what the word Afrocentric viewpoint means.
Well, we use the term African-centered. And what we mean by African-centered is everything is viewed through our own cultural lens. So when we talk about taking an African-centered view of economics, we have to ask ourselves, what is in the best interest of our individual and collective survival? And in this case, we talk economically. So for example, one of the principles in my book is we want African people to patronize Black-owned businesses with 5 to 25% of their income. Now, what does that do? What that does is you're beginning to see money being exchanged between the Black customer and the Black merchant. Okay. And every time you support a Black-owned business, that money could keep that Black merchant open for an extra week. It may be able to hire an extra individual or two. Okay. And you're beginning to build what I call economic synergy. So if I were to go into an ethnic community, within that ethnic community, every business should complement one another, not compete against one another. And the example I use in my book is when I talk about barbershops and hair salons. Okay. Who is developing the warehouse distributor to where now I am turning my potential competitor into a customer? Okay. Where I'm not competing with the next barber, I'm supplying him with the supplies he needs to run his barbershop, or to run her nail salon, or to run her hair salon.
Yeah.
You see? And then from there, guess what? All of them need tax advice. All of them need insurance. And then all of them need to be able to put their money in a financial institution that understands the needs of how to grow a Black-owned business. Okay, so that's why I talk about in my book, where I talk about economic synergy.
I absolutely love it, yeah. Economic synergy is one of my favorite words. And while you were speaking, just to make a point, I found a little, I hope everybody got to see it, and I can bring it up again. Just the difference between Tulsa, like my mama said, that happened in 1921, and how that has affected today's racial wealth gap. You know, I went to the African American History Museum recently, and the way they had it coined was punishing success. And then they listed all of the different ones, Tulsa and Rosewood and... I'm drawing a blank, but there's so many where we were attempting to establish our own communities of wealth and economic synergy, communal synergy, and because of which, even though that was what they said they wanted from us, you know, pull yourselves up by your bootstraps, the American
dream. Jim, we didn't want you, we didn't expect you would be that well off without us.
Right. And then for our success, our reward was a bombing.
Yeah.
Imagine the United States bombed their own citizens because of their financial success. Isn't that going towards the entire economy?
Not necessarily. No. If you understand oppression and domination from that aspect, it makes sense.
Perfect sense, yes.
Okay, because, well, I'll use this example. All right. Let's take Negro League Baseball. Negro League Baseball at one point was the third largest independent Black-owned entity in America. Negro League Baseball was growing so popular, 20% of its fan base was white. Because white folks got tired of waiting for Major League Baseball to bring Josh Gibson, to bring Satchel Paige to Yankee Stadium to go up against Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb and those other baseball folks that Major League Baseball celebrated, okay? And here's the other thing. Negro League Baseball was more international than Major League Baseball at that time. They were actually barnstorming all throughout Latin America. We're talking Cuba, Mexico, Costa Rica, Puerto Rico. In fact, that's how we got our brother Roberto Clemente. By going through Puerto Rico and then picking him up, bringing him into the Negro Leagues, and then eventually with him playing in the majors for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Okay. So what did you have to do? So I know a lot of people saw the movie 42, which talked about Jackie Robinson. The move that Branch Rickey did by bringing Jackie Robinson into the majors, that wasn't about social progressiveness. Okay, that was about breaking an economic stronghold. Because what that did was, now when you start plucking our players one by one, first you got Jackie Robinson, then you get Larry Doby, then you pull Satchel Paige, and then Josh Gibson. So now you slowly but surely dismantle an economic, an independent economic power base that we had. Mm-hmm. Okay. And now it's to the point, and here's what Negro League Baseball did do. It showed Major League Baseball that there was a totally different talent pool to where today, there are baseball academies all throughout Latin America. Okay. And what I mean by that is, you've got academies that are bringing in talent that gives us a David Ortiz, a Pedro Martinez, a Manny Ramirez, Albert Pujols. Okay. To the point where now American born Africans, you don't really see in Major League. You don't even see us playing baseball, because now we've moved into football, basketball, possibly track, and combat sports like boxing and MMA. Okay.
That's so interesting. So they made us back to the brute from the intellect, right? Not to say there's any less intelligence from the physicality of boxing, but it's just kind of like the Trojans and the gladiators, you know. I'm watching you maim and murder somebody for sport.
Well, you know, and I'm focused really more on the business side of it, not so much the pugilistic aspect. So you can understand how every time we create an industry, there are always entities that are looking to dismantle it because we pose such an economic threat to it. Okay. So that's why I brought up the whole thing with Negro League Baseball. And then later on, you look at what happened with the HBCUs once that 1964 Civil Rights Bill went into place, how it basically dismantled HBCUs to where now Grambling is no longer a football power, it's LSU. Right. Okay. It's no longer FAM, it's Florida State, Florida, University of Miami. Okay.
So you mentioned about the self-defense mechanism. Mm-hmm. What self-defense mechanism do you have when you're so entrench our culture, our country is so, it's a melting pot now. You can't extricate all of the black pieces out of the soup anymore. It's too much, and we're
But this is where you have to study immigrants, okay? And I'm going to pull out the Bible, okay? Blueprint for Black Power by Dr. Amos Wilson, all right? And what he talks about in here is that you still have ethnic groups who practice protecting their own self-interest. Okay, I'll give you an example.
All right, there you're coming.
When we go into business, okay, we create businesses as individuals. When you see immigrants come into a situation and build their economics, they build cartels. So let's take the nail salons that you see by the Vietnamese, okay? They don't just build one, okay? They're building maybe 12 to 15 that are strategically located throughout a municipality. Versus the one we may have set up. All right.
How strong is your why?
Right. And so when we talk about, you know, you're talking about the self-defense mechanism. When you organize yourself to protect your interests, now you have power. So when you come to the round table of power at City Hall, or whether it's at the state level or the federal level, you're not coming as an individual. You're coming as a collective, as a conglomerate, to say, okay, we are not going to allow Pathmark to build in these zones. Okay. Or we're not going to allow, you know, whatever grocery chain, depending on where you are in the country, to come up in here and build in these zones. So that's one way of protecting your interest. That's part of the self-defense mechanism.
So you create the stronghold and then you maintain it.
Right. So what I tell people is, there's really no such thing. You may talk free enterprise, but what you practice is monopolizing.
Monopoly.
Okay. That's what you practice, is monopolies. And I can tell you, going back into the early 2000s, being here, probably two of the best cartels that I've seen happen is Subway and Starbucks. And when they decided to spread, they spread like viruses to knock out any potential competition that may interfere with what they're trying to do.
And it's not even good. I mean, okay. Subway's not,
but that's the power of organization.
Yes.
Okay. And so, like I always say, it's one thing to where you say you have a better product than Subway. It's another when you've got to deal with their model, their distribution system, their teams, etc. Okay. So the power of
I was going to ask you that, the power of organization, but within self, how do we become the group of collective? We've been known as the crabs in a barrel for so long. How do we become infectious in that thing again? Because you desolate a people over and over again, you kill their spirit. And that's what I see across the board, is that a lot of us, our spirit has been killed to where we can just talk and ruminate about what we would do, but we're not gonna do it because I'm too fearful. How do we separate and sever that tie so that we're no longer fearful?
Okay, one, let's stop calling ourselves crabs in a barrel, because the barrel is not an indigenous environment for crabs. If you put crabs in their indigenous environment, their behavior changes. They're not pulling one another down. They're actually working together in synergy. Okay. So I think that's part of the thing where we have to begin to start thinking along different lines. So when I talk about organization, the organization really has to begin with you. Okay, I've always say revolution begins in the mirror. So when you talk about organization, are you organizing yourself, organizing your mindset, organizing your resources, or what I call your resources, your information, and your people? Because that's really what it really boils down to: your resources, your information, and your people. All right, you organize those three into a system or into a blueprint that will lead you to financial freedom and economic independence. And part of what I'm working on now is developing a workbook journal to accompany my book. And one of the things that I'm focusing on is having us begin to think in 90-day windows. And I'll tell you why. When Chairman Mao Zedong came to power in 1949 in China, where basically he defeated Chiang Kai-shek, China developed a 100-year plan. So by 2049, that's right, China would become the big man on campus, and they will basically be that global economic power. And they're probably 80% of the way there now. Okay. So I said, if I can take that and then, you know, narrow it down to where to get us to start thinking in 90-day windows. So, for example, every 90 days, you should be hitting some type of financial milestone. Okay, so let's say,
So let's say
I know today is April 24th. So let's go to next Monday, which will be May 1st. So let's say May 1st, over from May 1st to whenever the end of that 90-day period is, I will have, like Dave Ramsey talks about, having an emergency $1,000 stashed. Okay, that can be a financial milestone. Okay. And then once you achieve that milestone, the next 90 days, what do you want to achieve then? Okay. Is it, do I want to purchase the proper life insurance for me, whether it's term, whole? And I know there's a big debate about which is better. Okay. But when we talk about moving in 90-day windows, I think it's easier to digest things. So let's say you start operating in 90-day windows. By the end of 5 years, look at what you've accomplished because you've broken things down in 90-day windows.
One bite at a time.
You read my mind. There's only one way to eat an elephant.
Okay. So it's really about simplifying. And then once you simplify, then you can be able to build on those basic building blocks. Okay.
But the problem is, me and my mom, we tax for shit to do. There's everybody's gonna have 1,001 excuses. So, based off of your book, what is the one thing that everybody could do tomorrow?
Okay. Everybody, and I don't know who has a bank account or what have you. All right. Now, me, I have a credit union. So, my credit union offers, and I'm probably dating myself, it actually offers a Christmas Club account. Okay.
Mine too.
Okay. So what I can do tomorrow is to sit down and say to, you know, whoever the bank representative or the credit union representative is that each week I want X amount of dollars, or for those who are still working, every payday, I want X amount of dollars wired into this. So that way, payday comes, it's wired into the Christmas Club account. You don't see it. You don't have to think about it. And it's not easily accessible.
Right. Till October.
Right. Till October 1st. Okay. And in the meantime, what you can do is, while that money is accumulating, you have to give it a job. You don't want lazy money. Okay. So as that money is accumulating, what will be its job once it's released back into your checking account? Okay. Are you using that money as seed money for real estate investment, or to enter into the stock market, or to
trade on the stock exchange?
Right. Or to, you know, create a business. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that money is being used to create and or purchase assets. Okay. So that's why, and this is the thing where I talk about, we have to play more offense if we really want to be financially free and economically independent. Doesn't mean that you're not playing defense in certain situations, but if you want to be financially free and economically independent, you've got to play offense.
All right, so now we got the team on the offensive, right? Tomorrow, everybody's going to go out to their bank accounts and start their Christmas Club or whatever their banking system is. I'm pretty sure you're absolutely right that every bank out there now has some kind of thing where you can either from your direct deposit from your job transfer the money from one account to another, split your accounts, however you want to do it.
Right.
Once they do that, they then have to write up some kind of plan so that their money is not just going to be lost once it is released back into that account, correct?
Right. And another thing you need to start doing is changing your vocabulary. Start learning financial terms.
Terms, right.
Okay. So there's a good website. It's called Investopedia. I think it's investopedia.com, where it teaches you different financial terms, and it goes from A to Z. Because if you're going to master money, you've got to understand the language.
Yes.
Okay. Have you guys found the website?
Not yet. It took me to somewhere else. I'm listening to you and typing it in. As soon as I get it, I'm going to put it up on the screen.
Okay. Yeah, it should be in investopedia.com.
Gotcha.
And it should give you that whole listing of financial terms.
Yes. Gotcha.
Okay, that's the website. And it should find, let's see, where it says terms.
Right.
Financial terms or
just dictionary.
Oh, that's what it's called? Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Start off with the numbers and then A all the way through Z.
Okay. And from there, let's say so you start. So let's say every day you say, I am going to learn 5 new financial terms. Okay. How long would that take? If you tell yourself, I am going to learn 5 new financial terms each day. Or depending on what your schedule is, you can just say, let me learn 1 each day. But you want to be able to talk the language of money when you sit down with someone who may be a financial professional, whether it's a certified financial planner, an investment banker, or someone who deals with money for a living.
That's amazing. That resource right there, I mean, it already has things for children. And for those that are novices, learning as an adolescent would be, it seems like a phenomenal way to like bring together a group of people and do an experiment in learning with one another. Thank you for that.
Yeah. And I don't know if I have it in front of me, but there's a book, and Brother Sekou and I, well, I had mentioned a book to him. The book is called Make Your Kids Millionaires. Okay. It actually came out last summer. Along with my book, a friend of mine in the Bronx and I, we're going to use his daughter as a guinea pig, where there's an 18-year blueprint from the womb to the time the child is 18. To where we can put that child on the road to financial freedom and economic independence.
Yeah, from the womb to the tomb. That's the idea. But
well, for this book, you know, the first 18 years will establish that foundation for the rest of that child's life. Okay. Because I think what happens is, and one of the things that I can't remember if I mentioned it in my book, but one of the things I recommend is that you do not give your children an allowance. Because we have to, and I'm saying this for as African people must get back into the habit of teaching our children how to create money, regardless of the state of the economy in which we have to operate. In fact, being Black in America should make you automatically entrepreneurial minded in the first place. Okay. So no matter what the state of the economy is, our young people need to know how to create their own money. And when you start giving an allowance, now what you're doing is you're setting the stage to train them to be employees as opposed to employers. So we have to be very mindful of the of how we teach money lessons to our young people.
That's good.
You know, I didn't even think about that. I was always opposed to allowances with my children. I always wanted them to, I tell them all the time, there's certain stuff I'm not gonna pay you for. Like you have to take out the trash, you have to clean your room, you have to help me with the laundry and blah blah blah. However, if we move somewhere and we now have a yard, I can pay you a couple dollars for cutting the yard because you ain't had to do that before, you know. And that may, when you grow up, that may not be a choice that you want to make, but again, that's my humble attempt at trying to teach responsibility and earning something for yourself.
Yeah. And like I said, here, you know, being in this post-pandemic economy, our young people really need to know how to create money. With all of the technology that is at their fingertips, we need to start teaching our young people how to use that technology for empowerment and not entertainment.
Oh my goodness. Can I just throw this in here right quick? I am over this idea that people are walking around, kids are walking around with $1,000 equipment, cell phones. And this is the key to the whole. I had a set of encyclopedia or two. I didn't have information accessible to me 24/7 like these kids do. And to see them misuse it, they don't know how to spell, they don't know how to type, they don't know how to type their thumbs, they don't know how to read, they don't know how to ask the right questions. They look at Google for stupid stuff, but they won't learn anything. This is an education. This is free education. You know, and we mentioned last week that, you know, you can read a book, you know, and learn more than people with college education. Yeah. And it's just a waste of intellect to have kids walking around with this kind of, you know, these kinds of abilities and knowledge in their hands and literally at their fingertips, and watch them walk around fumbling through life when they don't have to. You know, anything you want to know, anything you want to know, YouTube, Google, it's there. And it's just unbelievable how they're flunking out of school. They're not passing their SATs. There's no excuse. There's really no excuse.
Well, it also goes back to mindset. You know, it's mindset that determines whether something is an asset or a liability. So when we talk about, you know, iPhones and Androids, you know, I was watching an interview with Bill Duke, famous film director, and he said that there was a situation where a small group of young people actually were able to create a feature film with 5 iPhones. That's all. Just 5 iPhones. And they were able to turn that technology and create an asset. Okay, but that all goes back to mindset in terms of how do you make it work for you?
Yeah, right.
Okay, and I don't want to beat up on the youth because I can't beat up on the youth without beating up on us.
Yeah, okay? It's not their fault. I mean, you know, they were given it, but they weren't taught how to use it.
You know, so, but in some cases, we do have young people who are now able to use that technology to their advantage. So it all is not lost on the youth. It's just, do we get them at a young enough age to where even before we give them the tools, we give them the, how would I say, we give them the cultural foundation first as to how to use this technology and why to use it for the best interests of your people.
So I got to bring this to light because, again, I told my mama knows I'm super excited about going to the whole African-American History Museum. They have this new term, new to me anyway, that's called Afrofuturism, which is exactly what you're talking about in terms of there is this time period where we are very intellectual. And now in the future, we're, you know, going back and tapping into that mindset. I really, really, really wanted to bring light to that because it centers around Black history and culture and incorporates one, science fiction, technology, and then futuristic elements like literature, music, and visual arts. It's okay. For our age range, Parliament, Funkadelic, George Clinton, you know, the people, if you've heard of them, Sun Ra, that are saying, hey, we're not humans, we're aliens, but we don't mean alien as in like not from here, but we do mean alien as not from here because we are guided by a different code. We have a different, like mom knows, the DNA, a different structure that makes us maneuver in such a way, like you're referring to, sir, with your book. It's our nature to be prosperous.
Yeah.
What I talk about in my book, and I use the term more Afrofuturology, and I'll tell you why. My ancestral teacher, Brother Steve Coakley, always asked the question, there's plenty of Black historians, but where are the Black futurists? So in other words, who is the Black Buckminster Fuller? Who is the Black Alvin and Heidi Toffler? Okay. So where is that cadre of Black futurists that's creating a future or forecasting a future for African people? So I look at Afrofuturology versus, you know, the Afrofuturism, because, and not to take any shots at Afrofuturism, I just fear, are we going to look at this as another form of entertainment as opposed to Afrofuturology, where we are taking African people who are studying various disciplines, okay? And from those disciplines, we can either forecast a future or we can begin creating a future for African people. So, for example, when we look at what technology has done, okay, I read an article right now where in India, they were showing a robot being like a taxi. Okay. You know, you know how you see those, you see men that are, they're carrying those two wheel taxis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're showing robots doing that now.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because this morning I was looking at the news, I guess it was this morning. And, there was a mayor, the Black mayor, female, what was her name? I was going to say it, but I lost it today.
Okay.
She was introducing these robot dogs and robot police to help police the city. Maybe it was Baltimore. I'm not sure.
Yeah, they've got that in New York City now.
You know, and it almost seemed like surreal that this was happening. It reminded me of a movie like iRobot, like they're actually using robots now to manage crime.
Okay. And see, this is why when you watch movies, like I was having a conversation earlier with an older brother, I said, what you're seeing now with law enforcement engaging in robotics, I said, go back to the 1996 movie Judge Dredd with Sylvester Stallone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, where, and it was based off a British-based graphic novel. Okay, so what they were doing was they were actually cloning and creating cops who were being judge and jury right on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so So you're being shown something maybe 30 years ago that now is no longer science fiction, it's science reality.
Art imitating life. Yeah.
Okay. Even to the point where, and I've seen this firsthand, where I've seen robot janitors in Walmart.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the type of future that, what are we doing to prepare our young people to be, to have their labor rendered obsolete before they get their driver's license or before they graduate from high school?
We created it. I mean, we created that by being inhumane. I mean, it's really sad. It's not funny what I'm saying, but when you go to the drive-thru and the people can barely speak English to ask you, what do you want? You know, or they're handing you your change while they're looking at you. Don't even acknowledge that you're a human and count your change out for you or speak to you. Hey, how are you? Having a good day? They did this to themselves. I'm sorry. I'm not saying anything about the youth. I'm glad they don't have that option to be, to have to work and be laborers, and that the machine's going to take care of it, because we have more to do with our minds and our bodies than give labor our time.
So that's why I say, and there's another book that I want to throw into the record. Okay. The book is called The End of Work by Jeremy Rifkin.
Oh, I've seen that.
Okay. The reason I bring that book up is because there's a chapter in there. It's chapter 5, Technology and the African-American Experience. Rifkin said that he had to fight the publisher to keep that chapter in there. What that chapter talks about is how we as a people have been victims of technological advancement as opposed to benefactors of it.
Mm.
Okay. And that's a very significant book. And like I said, read chapter 5 if you don't read anything else in that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you read it, you'll see why Rifkin had to fight to keep that chapter in the book. The publishers didn't want it in there.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Never want the truth, do we?
Okay.
Jesus, listen, that's hot. And you've given so much information. One, about the money mindset. Like, again, we had to follow up this month of April with the stressors, the main stressors. You, me, we all in the same community. I know that money stresses me out sometimes, but I'm working myself on releasing those mental strongholds that we talked about and being able to go forth. There are certain areas where we're all super strong. Right, I'm a phenomenal student, but in certain areas I lack discipline. It is a thing. But together we're fit to heal, and we've come today to continue to give you ways to release two of the main stressors. One, last week we talked about finances and money, and now we're talking about the straight money. If as a person, the better you are with your finances, the better you are with your money, the more peace that you have, because you feel like you're in control, I would think. So let's sign off real quick. I really, really want to say thank you to our guests, my co-host, my mama. Tell us where we can find you, and we'll tell them to find us again here next week at 7:15. Go ahead, Brother Zumbi, tell us about yourself and close it out.
Well, I call myself a servant of African people who have done many things at many times in my life. Presently, I have my book, The Gospel of Afronomics Theology, which can be purchased through Amazon or your local Black bookstore. I'm working on the expanded edition of it now, where I've added 5 chapters to it. One of those chapters, I talk about a concept, what I call Afropreneurship, where we look at entrepreneurship through an African-centered lens. I'm also working on finally having a website presence, you know, so I can bring myself into the 21st century. A lot of people have asked me for that, but, you know, when you're the chief cook and bottle washer, Things don't move as fast as you would like, but they're slowly but surely making their way.
I appreciate you, brother. Tell us one last thing that the people can do outside of making a plan for their money and actually setting to stone either with their direct deposit or their bank account, just a couple of dollars every month. What else can they do?
The other thing, the website that I mentioned before about Investopedia, begin learning the language of money. Commit yourself to learning anywhere from 1 to 5 new financial terms each day. And you may not understand, you know, what all these terms are, but over time, you'll understand how to use them, and you'll understand their relevance towards your own personal financial situation. So the more you begin to learn and to know, you'll find your confidence will begin to grow. Okay, so you want to make sure that nothing becomes a mystery to you. Okay, so always, always be learning.
He said, always be learning. So, Mama, tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us how you can help us always learn and heal that money mindset.
Well, you know, like I said before, money touches all of our lives. We've been dealing with the stress of it, stress of financial Stress Awareness Month for the month of April, where we address the stress that come with the money mindset, understanding financial intelligence. We fear it, you know, most of us. You don't even have conversations with your own spouses about your own finances because we don't understand it and we don't like to talk about it, but we love to spend it. But there's traumas attached to it because of how we were raised and our parents were raised and their parents were raised, and they've created a bunch of incorrect belief systems. And as a result, we don't manage money well. We don't manage our fiscal responsibilities well. I'm just as guilty as anybody else. But I think it's important for us to look at ourselves as a whole person and be fit. That's just not just physically fit, but fiscally fit and mentally fit and emotionally fit. And with that wellness, addressing every aspect of our lives, including financial, we can become better stewards and of ourselves and what we possess and our resources. And don't, like brother said, don't stop learning. You never should. So just, you know, make it be mindful that your financial responsibilities and understanding and intelligence is just as important as anything else that you learn in life.
Super, super dope, Mama. And I'm so glad to have you on the show again. Hey, guess what, guys? It's time to close out. We were so glad that you could join us here on Fit to Heal. Remember, we're here to mental health, wellness, financial security. We want to, don't forget, every Monday at 7:15. We'll catch you again here. Mindset is a big beast that we gotta slay together.
Peace, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Great job.